Welcome to Deep Focus, a radio show about movies and New Haven. I'm your host, Tom Breen, and I'm joined in the studio today 2 weeks in a row. This is a new record in recent years.
Shocking, Tom. Shocking.
By my New Haven Independent reporting colleague and movie reviewing buddy, Alan Appel, to talk about Todd Phillips' new and very controversial movie, Joker. Alan, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so Joker is, well, on the one hand, falls into a very familiar genre of kind of contemporary blockbuster cinema in that it is in the superhero world, not the Marvel world, but the DC Comics world. This is part of the larger kind of Batman universe of characters, but it is unusual in that it focuses entirely on the origin story for one of the more iconic supervillains in this comic book world, the Joker. Here played by Joaquin Phoenix, and previously played in 2008 by Heath Ledger in the Christopher Nolan Batman series, and then by Jack Nicholson in the Tim Burton series in the early 90s. But here we have Joaquin Phoenix playing Arthur Fleck, I believe is the character's last name,
right.
Who is an incredibly disturbed man in this fictional Gotham City that is very closely based off of, if not 1970s New York City, the 1970s New York City as represented in the movies of Martin Scorsese. This is a movie where the kind of trash haulers union is on strike, and so on every single sidewalk outside of every single store and home, we see these huge piles of trash just kind of festering in public, waiting for the, anyone to come and clean it up, and much to the irritation of the more wealthy and comfortable in the world, but also maybe spurring on the discontent of the majority that is fed up with, you know, the gross income inequality that seems to beset this fictional world in the way that it does many actual world too. But Joaquin Phoenix, yeah, this movie's gotten a lot of attention, but for Joaquin Phoenix's kind of contorted and very kind of physically uncomfortable performance, but also for potentially, maybe glorifying is too strong of a word, but here we have the representation of a single white man mentally disturbed wreaking a heck of a lot of havoc. What'd you make of Joker, this kind of hybrid between a superhero origin story and a kind of gritty neo-realist 70s New York City movie?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't have too much deep knowledge of the Marvel and the comic book hero tradition. So I guess I was going in, mea culpa, forgive me. I was just going in to see a movie. And this is in my my little pot of movies where it just made me squirm. And if I didn't have to be sitting here and talking to you about it, I think I would have left. Not that I don't admire the evocation of a city in trouble and the production values of this, but I think this movie is just it's so problematical, it's so lost as a story. And the worst thing about it is that, I think ultimately, and I know some of the more alarmist reviews of this are concerned with, the film giving a kind of okay or carte blanche to, somebody who's really disturbed going out and, grabbing a gun and taking some sort of crazy action. The problem with the movie is that it, I don't think it's the intention of the filmmakers, but it's really a movie about mental illness, and it's not just about mental illness. It exploits mental illness. It glamorizes mental illness. I mean, there's a soundtrack of all these really kind of wonderful, nostalgic films, and Joaquin Phoenix's kind of languorous choreography makes it seem cool to be taking 7 meds in the first 5 minutes of the movie. I mean, it's really very problematical. You go with it for a while, but to what end?
Yeah, no, that, I think that that potential exploitation of the kind of entertainment value, maybe shock value of mental illness is something that also did not sit right with me after watching this movie as well. But I don't, I think was, you know, some fall somewhere in the middle on this movie. I think I might give it a slight recommendation. I definitely didn't hate it, but also, you know, found it a little bit too kind of derivative of the movies that it is enamored with, like the you know, Taxi Drivers and King of Comedy, and really anything Scorsese was doing in the 70s, which I think had, again, much, you know, more well-rounded characters and a more kind of realistic setting, and less exploitative of, you know, while equally violent, less exploitative of something like mental illness. But I did think that there wasn't anything glamorizing about this performance for me. Yes, we do have the soundtrack, like Cream's In the White Room, and then, you know, Rock and Roll Part 2 or whatever, you know, he's walking down, you know, part of the Arthur Fleck character's kind of actual physical journey on a daily basis, going up this this incredibly steep public stairwell to get to his apartment. And when we first see him doing it, it's kind of an exhausting experience, kind of trekking up endlessly to get back to his little hovel of an apartment that he shares with his mom. And then as the movie progresses, as he transforms, you know, more and more rapidly into this this alter ego of the Joker, we see him very jubilantly kind of dancing down the steps to these, you know, very familiar rock songs. But I don't think that it's necessarily a jubilation that the audience or the viewer is supposed to take heart in. Rather, it's a kind of terrifying descent. I mean, he's literally descending from, as he's dancing, he's descending from the top of the stairwell down into it and being chased by police in a kind of Keystone Cops kind of way. It strikes me as a pretty harrowing descent for a character who completely loses himself into an identity that he in part creates, but that is more kind of come up with by this, you know, large group of protesters, very angry about a larger kind of socioeconomic problem. I don't think that, I think it's an incredibly sad trajectory that this character takes, as opposed to one that the audience is supposed to think, oh, here is an exciting and kind of titillating progress for someone who is about to kill. And it just kind of left me with sad and uncomfortable, as opposed to just uncomfortable and icky.
Well, it's because you don't, the movie doesn't give you a moral point of view or an ethical point of view. It doesn't give you any other character, maybe with the exception of the maybe girlfriend, the attractive young African American woman. It doesn't give you any character with whom to identify to kind of assess, you know, what's happening to him, who's helping him, and so forth. I mean, because it's his own personal psychosis. As it gets deeper, it also kind of bleeds into the whole society, and to me, in a way that's an utter false moral equivalence. And you just don't know where you are. And, you know, as someone who lived through the garbage strike, hey, it wasn't that bad. It didn't last that long. The bags weren't that big. There weren't so many rats. And, even in the worst moments of kind of quality of life problems and fear for one's life, you know, nobody was running around, you know, the streets weren't full of people with masks and so on and so forth. I just don't get it. I mean, the movie's trying to make some sort of weirdo statement about how his psychosis is somehow necessary for the people to rectify what's ever wrong in the society that's led to his condition. I mean, I don't know what the thing is saying. And you know, I think you're trying to, when you say that it doesn't glorify mental illness or celebrate mental illness, it's sort of a distinction without a difference, because what else is going on in the movie except he's getting more deeper into it, and And he and in so many scenes, when he's not dancing and kind of finding mental illness, to use a word from the period, groovy, he has one Jesus pose after another.
Well, it's so one, we should emphasize that this is a, you know, Gotham is as fictional of a world as any other comic book setting. You know, this is very much based on an actual historical New York City, but the, you know, it's heightened. I mean, that's what these comic book movies do. It takes something that may have a kernel of truth and then ramps up whatever symbols of kind of decay and dissent and societal dissolution. I mean, because to say that the actual kind of New York City garbage strike didn't look exactly like this doesn't bother me as much in watching the movie, because I'm going in thinking this is going to be a heightened version of a reality that may be alluding to. But I do want to say that even though this is definitely Joaquin Phoenix's movie, I think he may be in every single frame of
That's
the movie,
right.
If not, definitely every single scene.
Right.
And the relationship between the he and this neighbor that winds up being, you know, predicated on a somewhat silly and predictable illusion, I think does not play as well for me as a different relationship that I actually thought worked really well, which was between him and the social worker assigned to him by, you know, the Gotham City municipal government, that, you know, we see maybe two or three relatively brief sessions where the social worker is a little bit disinterested, obviously overworked and underpaid, and that kind of culminates
too.
In her getting fired and then speaking very candidly about how, you know, the city to be run by, you know, the Thomas Waynes, this, you know, incredibly, you know, wealthy man who is, you know, some kind of millionaire who is running for government on the line that he's going to, you know, clean up the dreck as represented by people like Arthur Fleck. You know, she says they don't care about you, the mentally ill, and they don't care about me, who have made careers out of public service. And I do think that this movie draws a line between, you know, his mental illness is exacerbated by cuts to social services that then kind of happens simultaneously with this mass kind of appetite for rebelling against the rich. I don't think that it's as simple as just kind of mental illness gets worse and worse, but the movie does chart a kind of social collapse or a kind of infrastructural collapse around what could have supported, what could have helped this guy, but instead is left by the wayside and all he has left to him.
Well, that's true. I guess there's a slight critique, but, you know, but the movie doesn't know what it's doing with that particular theme. It just drops it in there like salt and pepper. I mean, what I find interesting, and the movie does nothing with, because I think it's not even conscious of what it's done, is that the only people he seems to be able to talk to are African Americans. The African American social worker, and then he has a connection in, you know, in a brief kind of affair with his African American neighbor. And then when he's trying to find out, you know, if he indeed is the son of Wayne, or, you know, if he was adopted and so on and so forth, information about which, you know, even deepens his psychosis. He has a kind of therapeutic moment with the clerk at the mental hospital where he goes to swipe the folder. So why is he seem, you know, what are we to make of that, you know, mental, a person with mental illness can more easily relate to an African American because they're more oppressed also. I mean the movie doesn't really know what it's doing, and you know, to your point that, you know, the saving grace of, you know, this is that it you know, it's not really Gotham, and we, you know, you really shouldn't treat it as a movie that's anchored, you know, that you shouldn't judge it except by kind of comic book standards. Well, you know, at the heart of the 1980s, one of the it was the Bernard Goetz incident, where this guy, you know, white guy riding the subway, shoots three people in the subway. They're African Americans, I think, that he shoots, and that's part that contributes to a kind of spiraling in the 1980s. the guys that these are elites, or that, you know, Wayne's guys that Arthur Fleck shoots. But that's the incident. I mean, you know, it continually kind of dips down into kind of quotations from real life incidents in the city. It also I just think it has a real point of view problem, and kind of clarity of vision problem. It makes me think of, for example, Network, where you have a guy, you know, the Network guy. Now it really compares to other movies where you have somebody who snaps. Who's the actor in Network? I can't remember.
I'm blanking on his name.
Not Peter Falk. No. Anyway, whoever it is, he goes nuts, but you know, he goes nuts within a world that where we can explore what you do with somebody who has reached a kind of snapping point that we all feel that we might also snap about. But in this movie, we just are invited to indulge with him in the oh so temporary freedom of having no boundaries. I mean, there's something wrong with that.
Peter Finch.
That's right. Faye Dunaway, I think, he snaps, and when he snaps, it does say something. It's a kind of comment about the general society in a way that you can take in and you can think about. Here, it's kind of all about the visuals and Joaquin Phoenix's body, and I just think it's confused.
You're listening to Deep Focus on WNHH LP, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm your host, Tom Breen, and I'm talking with Alan Appel about Todd Phillips' new movie, Joker, kind of origin story of the Batman supervillain starring Joaquin Phoenix as Arthur Fleck in the kind of immediate run-up to him becoming this notorious anarchistic and in this movie, severely mentally ill supervillain. Let's talk about the performance a little bit. If the direction and kind of writing and fleshing out of this character, I think both of us find pretty unsatisfying, especially in the context of the kind of meandering plot. What did you think of Joaquin Phoenix's attempt to bring this character of Arthur Fleck to life through an intensely physical performance, one where if maybe one scene sticks out to me, over the course of this movie, he has this very high-pitched, nervous, and uncontrolled laugh that we learned through a laminated card he keeps in his pocket and hands to people on the bus, that it's part of the fallout of some traumatic brain injury he may have suffered as a child.
Right.
That he laughs uncontrollably, it seems, when he's most emotionally distraught, but at least explicitly in inappropriate situations. So there's that laugh that is kind of a soundtrack to the movie, but also his body, which is, emaciated and spindly and constantly hunched over, and really emphasizing the grotesqueness of this character. Maybe
that's
that
right.
Adds to the exploitation of the mentally ill, but it is kind of a marvel, no pun intended, to watch someone do this with his body. I mean, it's kind of a feat for an actor who's wearing relatively little makeup besides the clown costume that he puts on. I mean, it's not like this is, some horror movie where the character gets to, put on a hump on his back and gets to, contort himself in a lot of unimaginable and kind of effects-enhanced ways. This seems to be just Joaquin Phoenix doing a lot of freaky stuff with his back and arms. But what did you think of the performance itself?
Well, you just used the word freaky, and I'm looking at my extensive notes here that I took on the movie, and one of them says Diane Arbus on the screen. I mean, this really is about grotesquery, and what's interesting is that as the number of masks that people wear on the street accumulate, and as you meet other characters and realize, they're not going to really be in the movie. It's going to go back to Joaquin Phoenix. I think you settle into deciding whether you're going to be happy, being close to this 39-foot face for 2 hours during the course of the movie. And I think he does a, you know, the only thing going for this movie is that he profoundly feels the you know, all the range of confused emotions, you know, the anger, the fear, the humiliation, the isolation, I guess there's enough variety in what he does with his face and his body to keep you going back. I don't feel bored when I'm looking at him, or when he's doing those those choreographed routines, or when he's, you know, in those composed sequences, like going up and down the steps, that, you know, those are, you know, scenes out of, I don't know, musicals, or, you know, it's also that's the famous door sequence from the John Ford movie, The Searchers, the end of The Searchers, you know, where the character is framed by verticals and a horizontal in a doorway. I mean, you know, that's okay. And in fact, apart from Joaquin Phoenix's face, to answer your question, yes, and his body, yes, that keeps you interested, because it's such a, you know, I guess it's such a true performance to a character. You know, I was going to say, it's an unfleshed out character, and he's got this like unfleshed out body, doing this unfleshed out character. But the other thing, of course, that you find interesting is there's so many movie quotations, Searchers, and of course to the Scorsese films, and you know, Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver spends half the movie without his shirt on, you know, and lifts weights and stuff like that. This guy doesn't lift weights. He does, you know, he does Martha Graham.
And I think, to this movie's credit, it is, you know, another movie it directly references. In fact, a whole scene takes place where, you know, hundreds of the Gotham elite are watching and chuckling along with this movie is Modern Times and Charlie Chaplin's, you know, the Little Tramp. The movie kind of bypasses contemporary cinematic clown references, if there are many, in that, you know, like Stephen King's It is, you know, maybe one of the more kind of prominent representations of these like horrifying clowns in contemporary movies. And I think that, you know, says a lot about what blockbuster movies lean towards in representing the incredibly disturbing, and that there's so much, you know, CGI animation, and you have this, you know, this terrifying shape-shifting, you know, grotesque doesn't seem to be the right word for what happens in movies like It. Rather, it's, you know, it's a combination of jump scares and I think really kind of overly familiar, not too emotionally affecting, just kind of spooks. But here we have someone going back to what Chaplin kind of pioneered in his representation of that clown figure, which was the way to communicate so much about the inner life of a character through the way that they move their actual body. Now, we may, you know, find, not that Chaplin's movies are necessarily the, you certainly don't have complicated plots, and not always interested in the, you know, the deepest, he certainly had, especially in movies like Modern Times, some pretty astute economic and social critiques. But I think that so much of what audiences latched onto with Chaplin was the way that he brought the Little Tramp to life through, you know, through the way that he moved his body. And I think that Joaquin Phoenix tries to bring Arthur Fleck to that level of kind of visceral connection with the audience by saying, here is someone who doesn't have the kind of he has the naivete of the Little Tramp, but maybe not the idealism of it. He's got the naivete and the incredible kind of inner hurt and sorrow befitting this particular setting. And I don't know, I was into that riff on the representation of a clown.
But am I being naive, or too just, you know, boring and just wanting to have a feeling that the movie has some cinematic intelligence behind it? To ask, why in the world would Thomas Wayne and all those people in an opera house, you know, wearing tuxedos, why in the world would they be watching Chaplin, a Chaplin film, under this? I mean, they've called all these people in the world who are underachievers clowns. They have they're full of derision for them. Why would they be sitting there and watching them except to give the filmmaker an opportunity to show the clip?
It
strains credulity. I mean, it just shows there's a guy who likes movies and wants to be direct good movies, and he's got a lousy movie here, but he's dropping into the film, the parts of films that he enjoys. It totally strains credulity, it seems to me. And I mean, if you're completely in a comic world, I guess that's okay. But you're not completely in a comic world. You're in a world that kind of mimics, not just mimics, but almost quotes, images and feelings and music from a real New York. And it just doesn't. And then you're expected to, give permission for him to do something that has no credulility. Likewise. Rant go on?
Well, let me just throw in about the Modern Time. I want to hear the like, but in terms of, I actually read the Modern Time screening as kind of similar to, Ronald Reagan playing Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA at seemingly every campaign rally, but, completely misinterpreting this on surface level, just based on the chorus, potentially patriotic song. And here we have, the super elite of Gotham laughing along at a superficially, just kind of clumsy slapsticks, clown doing silly things and completely missing the underlying critique of brutality of capitalism, stuff like that. The Chaplin's and his movies were actually interested in, especially Modern Times. But so that's at least that was the.
You've got the intellectual interpretation absolutely right, but cinematically, it's not true.
Strains credulity
beyond and speaking in the credulity department. I mean. Maybe because I was going in expecting a movie, but a guy with giant bozo clown shoes in the very first sequence, chasing these guys who wrecked his sign, these young teenagers who are assaulting him and setting the tone for the city in the movie. There's no way he could run so fast in those long shoes. I mean, I said to myself, what? How is this possible? He's got in the truth department, he's got like two strikes against him in the first 5 minutes of this film.
We'd be remiss if we didn't talk at least a little about Robert De Niro, who maybe has the largest, in terms of screen time, supporting role, and that he plays Murray. I'm blanking on the talk show host's last name, but the first name is Murray. And
the name is Franklin,
Franklin.
There was a famous, has been already in the 1980s, talk show host, and his name was Joe Franklin, a real Franklin, right? Who was really a has-been even at that time.
So this is probably the most direct reference to and even just recreation of Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy, which starred Robert De Niro in the Joker role, and then Jerry Lewis in the role of the talk show host to this young aspiring comic.
What was the name
feverishly.
Of
feverishly
Rupert something?
Oh yes,
Rupert Puppick or something.
Yes, Pumpkin.
Pumpkin.
I think, yeah,
and they always mispronounce his name Pumpkin, but it's Pupkin.
But so Robert Jr. plays this incredibly successful late night talk show host who Arthur Fleck longs to be a guest, kind of fantasizes, even loses himself in. Again, I think one of the more successful self-contained sequences where. He completely transports himself from the couch in this, again, really sad and dilapidated apartment into the audience of this talk show host. And then he's invited up by this surrogate father figure and given a hug and validated and all this stuff. But
it's in his mind, right?
Right. It's on his mind. And, I don't know if you remember Requiem for a Dream, that kind of another harrowing 90s movie by Darren Aronofsky, but there's an older woman who becomes addicted to various, I think, speed that she orders through some, television promotion. But she, too, kind of transports herself. The obsession with validation through being on TV is always a fascinating theme for me. But here, so we have the Arthur Fleck character eventually actually making his way to being a guest on the Murray Franklin Show, not because of any successful comedy that he performs from Murray's perspective, but rather because the talk show host who this, Joaquin Phoenix's character idolizes, wants to make fun of him in public because of how terrible stand-up is. And then this results in a variety of predictably, like, really terrible and violent things.
Shoots her in the forehead, right in front of the camera.
But what did you...
Which has also happened before. I don't know if it was at that time, but it wasn't talk show. It was like it was some deranged guest, or was it...
Yeah, I know who shot herself in Florida in the 80s, but I don't remember
well,
if
there
was a guest.
An interviewer was shot by an irate guest. I mean, hey...
So what'd you make of the subplot and De Niro's, you know, Murray Franklin and...
Well,
in all this,
the pleasure of it was it just reminded you of the Scorsese film, So what was the? I mean, I enjoyed it, but what drives this film? It's on the basic plot level. He wants to get on this show. And on the deeper character level, he wants to establish who his father is, and those two things are going on. It's actually quite well plotted from that point of view. The action where his discovery of the different clues that he turns out not to have this famous powerful father, and that really contributes to his descent into the psychosis.
And I think the parallel kind of disregard and just kind of humiliation that both potential father figures inflict on him is also, you know, could be moving. Actually, the confrontation at the end between Fleck and Murray Franklin, I think that, you know, it's kind of telegraphed from miles away. So it's not necessarily... doesn't necessarily engage by virtue of its surprise, but it certainly is one more in a movie filled with, steps or representations of just the completely like distraught and disturbed inner life of,
right,
of this guy made manifest through violence.
Right. But, and, you know, it suggests it suggests that there is a world utterly without empathy. Here and there by accident. I don't know. I mean, it really is a kind of dangerous movie. I'm kind of sympathetic with, crusty people who think this is the kind of thing that could, you know, it's kind of insidious because it sticks with you. It's so visually striking. Knock on wood, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody with a clown face starts running around and doing some violence. I think it really is, for people who are on the edge, this is a very attractive way to go.
Hmm. Yeah, that's it. It does point at some interesting questions about the responsibility of art. Now, certainly plenty of people from the 70s on forward have criticized Taxi Driver for doing the exact same thing, for presenting this model in Travis Bickle for, you know, the lone, crazed, idealistic, but in a really, you know, sadistic and deranged way, young man who tries to, I mean, literally, I think the voiceover narration in that movie says that he's seeking to purify the world around him from, you know, of all of its evil and decay through violence. And I don't think that Scorsese is actually interested in encouraging people to emulate Travis Bickle, but certainly that could be one reading of it. And
But
Charles Manson also interpreted, you know, Helter Skelter by the Beatles as a call to arms to, like, you know, run a racist and kind of crazed murderous cult
in
California.
Right, but in Taxi Driver and the others, you know, in King of Comedy, I mean, there was a world out there where there were normal, pardon the expression, normal people. There was a world where...
Could you get a bit closer to the mic? I think
that was, a world of normal people, a world where there was help. But in this film, even the people that you point out who, you know, the African-American social worker, therapist, she's not a very good therapist, by the way, but in any event, she gets rehired towards the end of the movie, like a little like nanosecond of reprieve. And he's he's getting some sort of connection with her and some sort of therapy with her. And but that's the movie could have ended there, that he was getting some help, but it doesn't end there. The last scene in the film, there's a quick switch from his talking to her in a kind of therapeutic situation, where he's walking down the hall, having just finished talking to her, I guess. And he's tracking blood on his sneakers. Now, does that mean he killed her?
That was my reading.
So, my God, what's
the, well, and then the actual last shot is in this kind of slow motion slapstick chase between the security guard and.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it just is falling apart. It doesn't know what to say, kind of intellectually. So it just trying to create, I think, what the next visual image requires, without having a kind of thought antecedent for the image.
Well, certainly a departure from other comic book movies, which, you know, rely maybe a quarter on kind of witty banter between really handsome and beautiful people, and then three quarters on just the explosion of the universe and, you know, defense of it, and, you know, loss of millions of anonymous people's lives just for the sake of, you know, an entertaining spectacle. Here, we certainly have, you know, this movie ends with that level of chaos, but I think it's much more interested in potentially dealing with the unique psychology of this one character. Sounds like the success of that we are not necessarily on the same page about, but this is not a movie that I loved and will go to the mat for, but I do appreciate in theory that this is, you know, a different way to look at a comic book movie, to make a comic book movie, to focus so intensely on character and not necessarily on, you know, on the big bangs. But hopefully it will not have horrible ramifications for actual world,
right,
in the months and years ago.
Right, but well, we could go on about this, but you know, the essence of a comic book character is that it doesn't get all that much deeper than surface character, and here it's the it doesn't get much deeper than variations of you know, the kind of psychosis. It's neither kind of explored in its own right nor kind of, I think it remains a comic book movie, even though it has aspirations to go beyond comic books, is my point only.
Yeah, no, I would say that, again, through the physicality of Phoenix's performance,
yes,
I think that it does transcend whatever kind of superficial character development we are used to in comic book movies. I mean, I think that what he is able to communicate about the hurt inside of this guy just through the way that he contorts his shoulders and
his
other
true
limbs, you know, it's remarkable, but does not necessarily a quality movie make. Alan, thank you so much for seeing Joker and talking about it. And if you had to give a binary yes, no, see, don't see, recommend, don't recommend, would you, what would you say?
I would say see it, but, you know, warn any companion you take with you what's to expect.
Certainly glad I didn't see this one with Lucy. Not in Lucy's wheelhouse. Thank you, Alan, and talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
You can go to deepfocusradio.com to find years of conversations about movies in New Haven, and we will be back with you with another episode next week.